Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 18. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at films Maldi, and I'll explain that in a moment. Cursed films. The first one is a Russian Fantastica film from 1962, Amphibian Man, which is really a lot of fun. And the second one is 1983's Brainstorm, directed by Douglas Trumbull and starring Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood in her last role. So sit back, have a drink, and we'll get on with the show. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 4 weeks. It's a podcast of speculative fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Feedback's very important, so Soylent Green, in fact, and you can give feedback via my email address, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. You can find the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Faces, or you can send a voicemail to area code 206-338-9397. Now, occasionally, we do get some adult content on this podcast, so if you're easily offended by that, then you need to lighten up and accept the fact that the world is a diverse and wonderful place. Hi, how is everybody today? Doing pretty well here. The weather is just starting to warm up and spring is going to show up any day now. My online French language course is going ahead pretty well. I'm doing quite well with that, I think, though I'm not sure I'm up to speaking to a French person yet, but it does give me something to start the day with where I can achieve something before I even get to work. So that's kind of nice too. Now I'll just go into my mizo and we'll see what I've been watching in the genre-based realm of cinema. I did see a very old pre-code movie, Black Moon, with Faye Ray in it, which is kind of almost a precursor to I Walk with a Zombie. It's quite interesting there, and like a lot of these ones, it kind of treats the people of colour a little better than most of the contemporary movies of the time. I saw Elysium too, the movie with Matt Damon, the Neil Blomkamp movie with Charlton Copley, Matt Damon and Jodie Foster in it. Yeah, it's kind of flawed, but I kind of like it too. I think its heart's in the right place, but there is a moment in the movie where it jumps the shark just a bit by going totally like an old first-person shooter game. But having said that, I kind of like it. I think the visuals are striking, and I want to see more from Blomkamp as well. I think, yeah, if he takes on the criticisms that have been raised about this movie, he is definitely someone to watch. District 9, of course, being his debut in our scope. And, so it's worth seeing, but it's not as good as I wanted it to be. I've kind of lean towards liking what he does. And when things are slightly disappointing, you kind of wish for better in that sense. Let me have a look at what else I've watched. I did see a kind of very, 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 very low-budget movie, All Superheroes Must Die, which had James Remar and nobody else famous in it. It's not too bad. I mean, for the budget, which was something like $7.50, it's not too bad, and it's got a bit of a cult following there. Like everybody else, it seems, I did see Sharknado, the Sharks in a Tornado movie, which The Asylum put out. Very, very, very low budget again. But it's kind of fun. I like the fact that even though they do have the cheesy special effects, they decided to run with it and do things with a great audacity, which served them well. In fact, it actually got a cinema viewing here in Melbourne at the Kino. They showed Sharknado because they knew it was a cult following and people wouldn't mind seeing it on the big screen, which is kind of cool. Let me see what else I've got there that's worth mentioning. A lot of things aren't, but some of them are. Let's see. No, that's pretty much it. So, having said that, I've got to explain the term film Maldi. Now, I'm getting this from the Harvard Film Archive, so you know it's good. There was a legendary 1949 film festival in Biarritz, which had a jury led by Jean Cocteau, who curated and kind of curated and celebrated a group of films that were criminally overlooked and neglected at the time. And the films that they had on there were Le Atlante from 1934, Long Voyage Home, and Les Dames du Bois de Boulogne from 1945. So basically, the guys who put the film together, film festival together, were looking specifically for neglected films. Now, what shocked me was, that's what I've pretty much been doing for the last 7 years with Paleo Cinema and with the Martian Drive-In podcast. So it's normally, today the kind of meaning of film multi has changed. It says here, it's typically used to designate the latter category of edgy, troubling films, especially the mode of counter-cinema that flourished during the mid-1960s through to the late 1970s. Inspired by the period's intense socio-political turbulence and general loosening of censorship restrictions, a number of international auteurs took advantage of the newfound freedom to engage previously taboo subjects and push the loose genre of the art film into an adventuresome extreme. But the original meaning of it was cursed films, films that were neglected. So I'm going with the original one because I like it. And the music has just ended. Now, Film Mal D also has a meaning, which I've read elsewhere, of films that at the time were fucked up by the studios. They were cursed for that reason. Films like, for instance, The Magnificent Ambersons, which was recut because the studio didn't like what Orson Welles did. And nobody's ever been able to reconstruct it because the original footage was never found. And films, even a couple of lesser films, one of my favourites, 2 Weeks in Another Town, was edited while the director Vincente Minnelli was off somewhere else and totally screwed up the meaning of the film. It would have been a much better film had Minnelli been able to do the whole thing himself. And these films are really kind of looked on fondly by film buffs because they're the crippled children of cinema in a sense. And one of the two movies that I'm doing today is kind of sort of like that, that being Brainstorm from 1983, the Douglas Trumbull film starring Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood. And the other one of the films, The Amphibian Man from 1962, the Russian movie, is a film that's been neglected. It's not on anybody's radar in the West as far as kind of science fiction, fantasy films are concerned, but it's a really interesting piece of cinema. So I thought I would talk about them this time because I like Brainstorm a lot, and B, I've just discovered Amphibian Man, and it's kind of cool, and it does have a slight cult following in some areas, but I really want to kind of push it a little bit and encourage people to see it. Now, I'm doing that in two ways, the first one of which, of course, is talking about it on the podcast. The second one is that it is in full on the Martian Drive-In podcast website. Daily Motion have a full version of it with English subtitles. So if you go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com, you can watch it. So that's always nice when I can manage that. Couldn't manage it for Brainstorm, of course, because that one has fairly strong copyright. And The Amphibian Man is available. So go there, enjoy it, come back and listen to the rest of the podcast. Amphibian Man is a 1962 Soviet science fiction romance film, it says here. It stars Vladimir Korenev and was directed by Vladimir Chebotaryov and Gennady Kazansky. And I'm butchered them, I know that. Basically, the story is set in Argentina, of all things, a Russian film set in Argentina, in a seaside port, largely among a community of pearl fishers. This is from Wikipedia. The protagonist is the son of a doctor scientist who was sometime in the past forced to save his son's life by implanting him with gills. Thus, he is able to live underwater, but must keep his secret from the world. The conflict arises from his falling in love with a pearlfisher's beautiful daughter. His secret is discovered and the girl's stern father attempts to exploit him for his ability. I'm not going to go any further than that because there are some spoilers in there that I want people to discover for yourself. It's a little bit of a Romeo and Juliet movie, as it says here, but it's also very much a Soviet film. Now, at the start, people see the guy whose name is Ichthyander, being Latin for fish guy. and they see him as a demon. Basically, he swims around wearing a special silvery suit. It's got a helmet and goggles. The helmet's got a fin on it. The back of the costume's got a fin on it, and he has large flippers attached to it. So they can be mistaken for thinking that he's some kind of merman, but he's actually not. He's the son of Professor Salvador, a scientist. At the start of the film, he's kind of like the creature from the Black Lagoon. He's seen by the fishermen. They're scared of him. They see him killing sharks, for instance, when he does rescue the daughter of the pearl fisherman. And so they know there's a demon out there, and the pearl fishermen start to get a little bit scared of going out and collecting pearls, because, of course, they've got to dive to do that. All the pearl fishermen in the town work for a guy called Pedro Zurita, played by Mikhail Kozakov, and I'm going to stumble over these names all the way through this, so bear with me, who is basically the capitalist guy. He treats the workers badly, he doesn't pay them enough, he's nasty and venal, and of course, he's in love with the beautiful girl, Gutierrez, played by Anastasia Vertinskaya, who became one of the most famous actresses in Russia after this film. She went on to have a long career. She was in the theatre, in the cinema as well, and is a stunningly beautiful woman in a very kind of Russian way. But one day she falls off the pearl fishing boat and starts swimming for shore. Well, she doesn't fall off. She actually jumps off because she's pissed off with Pedro, and decides to swim for shore, but a shark follows her, and she's nudged by the shark and knocked unconscious by it before it's about to attack her, and she falls to the bottom of the sea. Now, I'm going to pause there before I tell you what happens to her at the bottom of the sea. This movie is based on a 1928 novel, which was well known around the world. It was, you know, one of the Russian novels that people really liked. At one stage, Walt Disney wanted to make an adaptation of it, a live-action adaptation of it, but they found there were too many under the ocean scenes, and so he gave up on it. This would have been around end of World War II kind of thing. He gave up on the idea because it was just going to be too difficult to film under the water. The Russians, with a lot less equipment than Walt Disney could have gathered, managed to do it in 1962 and made the good job of it. Now, the novel, like I said, it was well known everywhere. It's got to have been one of the origins for characters like Prince Namor of Atlantis, the Submariner, and Aquaman. It's kind of the progenitor of those two very vivid characters in the Marvel and DC universes. And Iskander, the amphibian man, kind of has a lot in common with particularly Prince Namor. The way he looks in the movie is not entirely dissimilar. Of course, Prince Namor was a cartoon character during World War II. But the actor playing him in the movie, whose name is, he said, fiddling with a mouse, is Vladimir Koronev. Is a good-looking, kind of slightly otherworldly-looking character. He looks like a Russian ballet dancer, in a sense, with a big mane of hair and beautiful eyes, and he's very lean and pretty much what we'd now call a chick magnet. And it's also got that otherworldliness. He's lived in this kind of mountaintop home above the ocean with his father all his life. He hasn't met many people. He's a kind of stranger in a strange land when he goes down into the village. And he's kind of got that naive Valentine Martin Smith kind of thing about him, which does lead to some problems when he does eventually visit the human world and while looking for Gutierrez, the beautiful girl. He doesn't know about money. He doesn't know how to act among other people. He needs to rehydrate because he can't be out of water for too long, and finds a little fountain in a zocalo and starts bathing in the fountain wearing his nice white suit, for instance. And the police and the locals don't take kindly to that because, of course, they draw water from the fountain. You don't want someone bathing where you draw your water from. But he doesn't know this, and naively, just impulsively takes a dip in there, for instance. And he kind of comes up against the realities of capitalism in a way, and absolutely has no idea. Now, there's also a kind of subplot there where Gutierrez's friend, Olsen, who's a reporter played by Vladan Davidov, runs a newspaper, but the newspaper's not doing very well because the vested interests of the rich people are working against him, giving them accurate pictures of the news and all that kind of thing. So she lends him, to Hawk, a pearl necklace which Pedro has given her. And she, Iskander finds out about this and decides that he's going to go into the ocean and get her a whole bunch of pearls. So he gets a fortune in pearls and brings them back in his cupped hands to her. And she says, no, no, I can't accept that. No, no. And he just throws them into the ocean. He's got no concept of money. He's got no concept of the value of things. And this kind of shocks her a little bit. And she really does realize how naive he is. But there's a darker side too. He and his father are eventually arrested by the authorities for various transgressions of that he makes legally by accident. And he's placed in a water tank in a jail cell for a prolonged period of time. Now, this is where it becomes very Russian. Unfortunately, the reason that Iskander is able to be underwater is that his father has transplanted shark gills into his lungs when he was young because he had a lung disease, and the only way for the child to survive was for his father, who's a whiz-bang scientist that lives in one of the coolest-looking science labs you've ever seen in your life. There's beautiful pieces of set design in there. I'm not sure why he's got a cage full of monkeys at the end of it, but he does. But his father's transplanted the shark gills into him, but warned him not to stay underwater too long. Otherwise, his proper lungs will atrophy and he won't be able to breathe on land. Now, of course, him being in this tank of water in the jail cell for a prolonged period of time leads to tragedy because he can't stay on land anymore. And of course, he and Gutierrez have fallen in love and are really passionate about each other, but their love cannot be. And so they part at the end of the movie. Now, that's not too much of a spoiler because, as I said before, you've now gone back and watched it, the whole movie, on marsdrivein.blogspot.com, and if you haven't, it's your own fault. But it's a lovely-looking film. It's very otherworldly, and the pacing and the direction the movie steers in is very different than it would in an American film of the time where the creature from the ocean is usually a monster. In this case, the monsters are all on land. They're the capitalists led by Pedro and the authorities and the jailers and the courts and the judges and all those kind of people. The capitalist society is the villain, and the people, particularly the most naive and innocent of the people, is the hero, in a sense. So it's got a kind of topsy-turvy look at these things based on what we know of American cinema, which is kind of cool as well. And there's also a really weird subplot with Professor Salvador, who's decided what he wants to do is get a whole bunch of volunteers, give them the shark gills so they can live underwater, and then start an undersea republic of free people, a kind of communist utopia under the ocean. Not sure how he's going to go about that because he doesn't seem to be able to get anybody else on board very much, apart from Olsen, the reporter, who understands why he wants to do this, even though he doesn't really think it's going to work. He and the professor are friends. But the film's a delight in a number of ways. There's a beautiful romance. And getting back to Gutierrez falling to the bottom of the ocean, there's some beautifully shot scenes of that with her just kind of drifting down to the bottom where all of the weeds and seaweed and everything else is. And I don't know whether this was deliberate or not, but Gutierrez's swimming costume becomes transparent to a great degree, and revealing the more lovely parts of her body. And of course, the amphibian man dives down and swims down and sees her and picks her up and lifts her back up to where the boats are. And it's a very erotic piece of cinema. It's not in a waka-chika-waka-chika kind of way, but in a gentle, lyrical, poetic eroticism. The fact that she's wearing the costume's transparent, and as he lifts her very gently in his arms up toward the air. And of course, she survives. She hasn't drowned or anything like that. But it's surprising, because Russian cinema was quite puritanical at the time, and that scene, being perfectly in tune with the rest of the movie, is a little bit of a surprise when you see it, but a nice surprise too. It's a way of using nudity tastefully, which I don't always approve of, but it's nice when it happens, and to kind of add that little bit of an erotic frisson to the otherwise slightly vanilla romance that's there. And I kind of like that. But the undersea shots are filmed beautifully well. You'll see a lot of parallels to a TV series from the 1970s, Man from Atlantis, in this movie. The way that the amphibian man swims is that kind of undulating thing with the fins on his feet. Very much in tune with The Man from Atlantis. But I think this is a much superior work. The cinematography is fantastic. The set designs are really nice. And then there's a weird parts on land where what you get is a kind of Russian interpretation of what an Argentinian town would be. There's a nightclub with a woman singing jazz music, for instance, which is kind of cool, but very weird at the same time. Now, I'll just play a little bit of the song, which became a hit in Russia, that you hear the woman singing in the nightclub, the kind of Russian interpretation of what a South American jazz club would be. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of the cross-cultural, but very nice weirdness of the film.
Нам бы всем на дно, там бы пить вино. Там под океаном мы трезвые или пьяны, не видно все равно. Эй, моряк, ты слишком долго плавал. Я тебя успела позабыть. Мне теперь морской по нраву дьявол, его якоря снимать, по местам стоять, эй, на румбе-румбе-румбе так держать. Дьяволу морскому свезем бочонок рому, ему не устоять. Эй, моряк, ты слишком долго плавал, я тебя успела позабыть. Мне теперь морской по нраву дьявол, его
so as you can see, there's a kind of lot of cross-cultural pollination in this film, which makes it unusual. Now, I started watching when I was slightly tired the other night, but it woke me up. And normally, if I'm feeling a bit tired and I'm starting to watch a film, it needs a big grabber for me to not go, okay, I'll watch it later on. But this one, visually, it started out beautifully. And it's just, while it's very much different from any Western film of the time, the story does draw you in, even with the subtitles. Even when I was tired, I stayed with it all the way through the film and really enjoyed it. It's a lyrical and Fantastica covers it. Now, I probably haven't explained too well what Fantastica is. It's a kind of portmanteau term that the Russians created for science fiction, fantasy, and horror films all together. And they didn't necessarily have the differentiations between the genres that we have. But this one really does cross the genres. There's a lot of science fiction in it, of course. There's a scientific rationale for the reason why Iskander can breathe underwater. There's the fantasy of the romance and the whimsy of that. And there's a little bit of horror in the way that Iskander is treated by the people in the town. But it's one of those things where occasionally with cinema, I can spend a lot of time watching crap. And I do. And I'll be honest about that. And I don't necessarily like myself when I do. I mean, I watch a whole bunch of rubbish. But then I'll get to a stage where I want to stretch myself. I want to get outside the comfort zone. I did in the last Paleo Cinema podcast by looking at the French New Wave movies. That's slightly outside of my comfort zone. But with these Fantastica films, particularly the older ones, there really is a need to get your head in a different space when you watch the film. And I think that's a good thing to do. Watching films from different cultures expands you in a way intellectually. And I kind of like that. I've always been self-educated, and I like that process of going, okay, what's that mean? And needing to analyze things to understand them a little bit more than you do with Western films, because there are a lot of, any film's got a lot of cultural kind of shorthand in it. There are things we know. If someone walks into a supermarket, we know about checkout chicks and all that kind of thing, which maybe people who don't have supermarkets in their culture don't know about. Things like that. But this one really did stretch me very gently. And I got involved with the characters, Iskander being kind of gawky out of the water, but beautifully athletic in the water, of course. And the beauty of Galtieri, the nastiness of the capitalists, the fact that they try to find actors who look kind of Spanish, but occasionally a Slavic face would turn up among them. And the beautiful set designs of Professor Salvador's laboratory and the villages and the boats, and the fact that Professor Salvador has a mini submarine with a harpoon gun on the front of it was very kind of cool as well. And it just drew me along gently like an ocean current into liking the film. I don't think it's one of the best movies ever made by any means, but I do love the fact that it's very different looking, and it's a very nice introduction to Fantastica if you haven't seen any films before. And remember, I've spoken about Night Watch and Day Watch on the podcast before, but if you haven't dived into Russian Fantastica before, this is a really nice entry point, because it's not too different, it's not too striking, and it's going to make you want to see more, which I really think is a good thing. Not too much else to say about it. It's there for you to enjoy. Please do so. It's worth your time. And really, it's a nice little glimpse into a certain period of time in what we all knew was a repressive culture. But in spite of the fact that the government controlled everything, and there were shortages of everything, and resources was thing, and they were trying to get to the moon before America did, and the Cold War was happening and all that. In spite of all of that stuff, a moment of beautiful film was created by people in that culture. And I think that's kind of cool, and it says something reassuring about human nature, that even in difficult circumstances, we can make beautiful things. And it's probably something that we all should remember at various times. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to go on with a much more accessible but no less interesting film, Douglas Trumbull's 1983 film Brainstorm, with Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood.
Suppose it were possible to transfer from one mind to another the experience of another person.
Hey, there it is.
Any person, any experience.
I'm telling you, it works.
The test, sound, taste,
everything, smell. Everything, 100%. In fact, better.
Did you have a breakthrough or not?
Yes.
I'd like a demonstration. Knock, my socks off.
What about military applications?
Wide open.
Missile guidance, that kind of thing?
They're going to be able to plug right into the old noodle.
I made that for you.
What is it?
It's me.
You've blown communication as we've known it right out of the water. You know that, don't you?
So something happened to me. It was more than just a sexual fantasy. It was a feeling I had. I'm more than I was, Mike.
I'm scared. But the thing is, I like it. I want more.
No, I can't authorize this.
The chance to take a scientific look at the scariest thing a person ever has to face.
This is not the research we're interested in.
This is my project. I don't want to see it end up on some defense scrap heap before we know what it's really about.
I want these personal experiments stopped.
I told you I want to play it out.
Nobody plays that tape.
Okay, let's get the elephant in the room about this movie out of the way. Natalie Wood died off the island of Catalina in her boat, The Splendor, after principal photography of this film was completed. On the boat with her were her husband Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken. Now, there's a lot of stuff going around about, did she die accidentally? Was she killed? What happened? Was she struck by a meteorite and then fell into the water? What happened? All of that I'm leaving aside. Really not relevant to the film, except in the sense of the studio shenanigans that occurred afterwards, and I'll talk about those a little bit further. Yes, she died. Yes, it was her last film. Yes, there's some argument there, but we're going to put that aside now and talk about the actual movie itself. Now, Douglas Trumbull, interesting character. He went on after this film. He didn't make another studio film after this. He went on to do things like IMAX films and also to... of all weird and wonderful things, I'm just going to get the details of this just correct because there's a lot of stuff here and I'm trying to get the actual accurate information. He went on to make amusement park rides of all things. His father, Donald Trumbull, created visual effects for the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz. Now, Doug Trumbull himself... started out, he did special photographic effects on 2001 A Space Odyssey, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Star Trek The Motion Picture, Blade Runner, and later on The Tree of Life for Terrence Malick. He directed two good science fiction films, Silent Running, which I've got a few problems with, and at one stage I may talk about it on the podcast, and Brainstorm. But I'll kind of get this stuff out of the way, the problem he had after Natalie Wood died. Natalie Wood died after principal photography, but there may have been... They used some body doubles on some retakes they had to do and things like that. But right at the time she died, the whole production was problematic. There were delays. Trumbull was more interested in the special effects than he was in the actors, and there's some talk that Christopher Walken directed himself and some of the other actors in a lot of the intense personal stuff there, and it was kind of drifting off... and doing what he wanted to do. The studio was aware of this, and basically, as soon as she died, they shut down production, and they were going to shelve it. And, of course, like all films of this size do, and it wasn't a tiny movie, they had insurance to make sure, the completion insurance. Lloyd's of London, who now no longer exists because of various shenanigans afterwards, were the insurers for the movie. Trumbull went to them and said, listen, I can finish this film. It's not a dead project. We can still get this done. And he gave them evidence that the film could be completed, released, and it wasn't a dead project. The studio argued otherwise. They put their bit together, put it to the insurers, and Lloyd's of London evaluated it all and said, no, Trumbull's right. We can finish the film. Here's some money for post-production. Here's a little bit of money for other incidentals. Finish the film and release it. They did. They made a loss on it. But the film did get released. Now, all of this shit took 2 years to happen, which is why the film, which was completed in 1981, at the time that Natalie Wood died, it wasn't released until 1983. The post-production was prolonged by the legal wrangling, the insurance wrangling, and, of course, the need to do the post-production. There were a lot of special effects in the film. All of that needed to be taken care of as a part of putting the package together and releasing it. So, leaving all that stuff aside, the film itself, I like it. And there are a few different reasons why I like it, too. And I'm just going to get my notes together because I wasn't organized here. Okay, so you've got the cast. Christopher Walken was a famous actor at the time. This is after he did a bunch of other films you might know him from. He'd done The Deer Hunter in 1978. He'd done Heaven's Gate, which was one of the great disasters of all time, Michael Cimino's movie. He did the striptease tap dancing in Pennies from Heaven around the same time. And, of course, in 1983, 2 years after he made Brainstorm, he played Johnny Smith in the adaptation of Stephen King's The Dead Zone. So he had a track record there as an up-and-coming actor. He'd started out on the New York stage. He started out as a dancer and an actor. And he was very, very into the method. He was very much a method actor and things like that. Then, of course, you've got Natalie Wood, who had been acting since she was a child, just after World War II. When she was 18, she was in Rebel Without a Cause with James Dean and Sal Mineo. At the same time, she was having an affair with both Dennis Hopper and Nicholas Ray, the director of Rebel Without a Cause. She was sexually precocious at an early age. And later on met Robert Wagner. They fell in love. They married. They separated in the middle 1960s. But at this stage, they were back together again. And by all accounts, were fairly happy with things. But she was a lady who was fond of gentlemen. And her career had kind of dipped into doing television movies and things like that. But Trumbull picked her up for Brainstorm, and she and Walken developed a great rapport together. Whether it was sexual or not, I don't know, but the rapport as actors were very good. She came from a Hollywood background, Walken came from a New York stage background, and while Trumbull was concentrating on the effects things, Walken taught Natalie Wood some of the techniques he knew as a stage actor in order to help her through the role as Karen Brace, the wife of the protagonist. Now, I should, at this stage, go into the plot of the film, which is not a bad thing. A team of scientists invent the HAT, a brain-computer interface that allows sensations and emotions to be recorded from one person's brain, converted onto tape, and then re-uploaded into other people's brains. The team includes a strange husband and wife, Michael and Karen Brace, Christopher Walken and Natalie Wood. Michael's a scientist, and Karen's a designer who's designing the interface. Along with them is Michael's colleague, Lillian Reynolds, Louise Fletcher. The CEO of the company involved with this, Alex Turson, Cliff Robertson, instructs the team to do a when they have the breakthrough, he instructs them to create a demonstration of the thing so he can wow the investors and get my financing for further development. Now, I'm just going to waffle about the rest of the plot. Basically, what the movie does is it shows the positive sides and the negative sides of this new and revolutionary technology. This thing is going to change everything. It's very much a tipping point. It's very much a paradigm shift in humanity. And the scientists are not unaware of this when they do it. Now, there are a couple of ways that they're shown. The positive side is shown because, as the trailer I played earlier shows you, at one stage, Karen is recorded. She gets recorded by Michael. And he then plays her recording and sees himself through her eyes and finds it a very, very confronting and shocking thing. She's pissed off with him because he's dismissed her new design just so he can get a recording. And so he gets a sense of their past history and how she sees it in quite a short time span of her having the helmet on and having the recording made. This is a profound shock. He's seeing himself through the eyes of his estranged wife, literally. And I mean literally in the old sense, not in the new sense. That he gets shocked by this and then decides that what he's going to do is make a recording of his own to show Karen how he sees their past relationship. And Karen plays this recording and they are reunited because of it, by diving deeply into each other's minds, literally, in a sense. They realize what went wrong and their relationship is re-established. That's the positive side of this new technology, where you can record and play back human emotions and feelings and sensations, and visually, auditorily, taste, sense, touch, everything. So that's the positive side of it. Now, there's a negative side of it as well. One of their co-workers, a guy called Gordo, played by Jordan Christopher, makes a recording while he is shtupping a woman. This recording gets around and everybody plays it in the lab, apart from the main people. It's a new kind of pornography. But one of the people, a guy called Hal Abramson, played really well by a minor character actor called Joe Dorsey, basically splices one section of that tape into a continuous orgasm loop and plays it for himself in his study at home, basically to give himself one continuous orgasm. Nobody finds him for hours and hours, maybe a day or so. And he's pensioned off because he's obviously not able to work. He has occasional kind of orgasm flashbacks, and obviously he'd gone through some kind of midlife crisis or some kind of personal trauma, where this was exactly the wrong thing to give him at the time. And this has played out very well, and I don't know how much of it is Trumbull, how much of it is Walken's influence, how much of it is the actors getting together and trying to figure things out while the technical side is being handled by Trumbull. But both parts of this are played very well. The positive side of it, where it rebuilds a relationship. The negative side of it, where quite a troubled man basically tries to commit suicide with an orgasm. And that's played out really well early in the film. Now, of course, one of the problems with this is that the American military find out about this new technology. And the government slowly, through the corporation and through Alex, played by Cliff Robertson at his most slimy, find ways to weaponize the technology in quite nasty ways. And there is one scene where Karen and Michael's son gets a hold of one of the toxic tapes and basically has a psychotic break because of it. They've decided that what they're going to do is they're weaponizing this whole technology. It can teach people things very quickly. It can give them experiences of experienced soldiers, for instance, and teach new recruits how to do it. That kind of stuff is really the killer app, in a sense, for this technology. And, of course, the scientists, Lillian and Michael particularly, don't want this to happen. And there's another complication as well, and this is a slight spoiler, but the movie is 30 years old, so I think you'll indulge me in this. Lillian's a chain smoker. She's lovely. Louise Fletcher steals the movie, in a sense. Her acting in this film is... she played Nurse Ratched, of course, in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but arguably this is her best acting role. She creates a whole character, a woman scientist who's dedicated to scientific research, who kind of knows what the threats are against that scientific research. She's very fond of Michael, who's a genius and who works with her. They've got a great and deep friendship. She has a friendship with Alex. She's kind of given up any prospect of having a personal relationship, as one of the flashbacks in her tape shows. And she's dedicated to advancing humanity, in a sense. She's probably a great role model for young female scientists in real life. Now, Louise Fletcher is fantastic in this, and you'll fall in love with her a bit in the movie because she's just such a cool character. As I said, she's a chain smoker as well, doesn't look after herself. She's in the lab. She burns her wrist with a soldering iron because they're patching together rough technologies, and then they're refined by people like Karen. They're putting together massive trolley carts full of superconductors that chilled down to near absolute zero, and eventually the technology gets down to a headset hooked up to ribbon cable. She burns herself with a soldering iron and then has a massive heart attack. And there's a prolonged scene of Lillian dragging herself across the lab, putting on the headset so that her death can be recorded. She wants to know whether there's an afterlife. She wants to know what happens at the point of death. She's a scientist and she wants to answer the hard questions. And there's a great scene which is really well directed and really well played, showing her heart attack and her death. And this is another tipping point in the plot of the film as well. Michael tries to play the tape and then almost has a coronary occlusion himself. The physical sensations create physical sensations in the person who plays the tape. He just finds a way to get rid of the physical kind of data point, data line, and just play the visuals and the emotional stuff without the heart attack and potential death. And one other character dies playing the tape as well. This kind of leads him into conflict with the authorities, and he's blocked out of the project eventually. And that leads to another interesting part of this film too. The fact that it's one of the first films I know of that shows computer hacking at all. Michael and Karen take a couple of mobile computers to tap into the phone lines to be able to get the tape and play the tape. So they've got a working version of the unit plus a computer with an acoustic coupler, which is a blast from the past technology. It's one of those things that cups onto a phone, an old school landline phone, and you play the data through basically a microphone. And acoustic couplers, I've played with them a couple of times back in the day, and it's kind of nostalgic and cool to see that. But all of this technology fits in an enormous suitcase. These days, it will be on an iPad, but back in those days, these days it would be like Bluetooth headset, iPad. But in those days, they were going with the technology that was slightly futuristic, which was enormous ribbon cables, enormous great big gaudy looking tapes for the recordings, and giant suitcases. Now the tape itself was actually a decorative tape that 3M made that they ended up using as the recording medium in the movie, and it looks kind of cool, and it's got that whirry sound that you heard on the trailer a bit too, and it's kind of almost getting to the stage now where it's retro futuristic, and that's kind of cool as well. But anyway, they hack into the system to get rid of all of the data, and nobody can reproduce the computer that these guys created, and they're trying to reverse engineer it so that they can understand it better and weaponize it better and things like that, but they bring in a whole bunch of second-rate scientists to do that, and they just don't get it. And meanwhile, Michael and Lillian have created this enormous supercomputer with wiring all over the place, which nobody else can understand. So Michael and Karen, with the help of Hal, who's recovered and retired, and his wife, basically hack into the system to wreck the factory they've created to weaponize this technology, and also to play Lillian's death tape, because Michael wants to know if there is anything after death, what Lillian saw, all of that kind of stuff. So the movie does get into a kind of transcendence thing where Michael eventually plays the tape, and there are scenes which have a certain ambiguity about them. They could be heaven and hell. They could be a collective unconscious. They could be some kind of transcendence and underlying structure of the universe. The fact that they go out, he sees himself zooming towards a distant galaxy, for instance, kind of leads me to think that the underpinnings of our religions are just a kind of glimpse at a deeper level of reality, and there are kind of misinterpretations of what actually happens at the point of death. Now, Trumbull does this really well. He's a special effects guy, And given that this is 99% done pre-computer graphics, and the computer graphics are on the screens are, and they've got old CRT screens, they're all wireframe graphics and things like that. Really, this is a film that was made about 20 years before it should have been, because given early 21st century computer graphics, it would have been a lot more wow factor. And there are parts of this film which do try to outdo 2001 in some ways. And the other thing too is, Trumbull wanted to do this in a film format that he had helped develop, which was about 60 frames a second rather than normal 24-25 frames a second. He had a 60 frames per second 70mm film process called ShowScan 60, which he wanted to use for that. The studio overruled him. So what they did instead was, the bits where people are using the hat were filmed in Super Panavision 70 with an aspect ratio of 2.2 to 1. The rest of the film was shot on 35mm 1.7 to 1. So basically when these scenes came up, when people saw the film in the cinema, the screen widened and became a super sharp Panavision 70mm screen. And then when they took the helmet off, it went back to the 1.7 35mm. Now, I didn't see the film in the cinema, but I would have liked to. Because of that, it's an interesting experiment, in a sense, to try to do that, to show that the hat scans and things like that are sharper than reality. And that's a kind of cool approach to tape, which I really tip my hat to Trumbull for that. I mean, I don't necessarily think that he was the best actor's director, but I think as a technician he was great, and he manages to tell a really interesting story, which is about the scientific process, about breakthroughs and scientists and innovation. It's showing the positive and the negative sides of a very big breakthrough technology, which is admirable and is at the heart of good science, good hard science fiction. And yet he also tells human stories, the story of Lillian and the story of Michael and Karen, and to a certain extent Alex, and the relationships between them all. And that kind of works, whether that's Walken's influence or whether it's Trumbull's influence or not. The movie balances really well the human and the technological stuff. Now, I'm not sure the ending, there might have been more of a coda to the ending had Natalie Wood lived and been able to film more of it. It does feel like it's a little truncated at the end because of that, and a little rushed at the end because of that. But whether or not it is, it still comes down as a film moldy, a cursed film. The death of a major part of the film after the big part of the production, the fights that were had with the studio about it, the fact that it eventually got released and made $10 million of its $18 million budget back, which is considered a failure, of course. But I like it because its heart's in the right place. It shows itself to be good science fiction, even though it does kind of drift into the metaphysical, and there's scenes that could be interpreted as heaven and hell at the end of the film. I don't reckon they are, but I think that they're a bit of a nod slightly towards that direction. And it'd be interesting to see Trumbull's viewpoint of it. And you've got to remember, this movie came at the end of the 70s where people believed all sorts of weird shit. In fact, Trumbull did get a lot of the crew to go to a meditation institute and spend a few days there to kind of understand where he was coming from, as far as the mental aspects of the thing were concerned. But that was a very hip thing to do at the time. This is back when people like John Lilly were experimenting with LSD and dolphins, and people were going into isolation tanks and all sorts of other weird and sometimes not too wonderful shit was happening. But having said all that, the film is a breakthrough film in a lot of ways. It does have some good acting in it. I mean, Louise Fletcher particularly brilliant. I think it's one of Natalie Wood's best acting roles as well. She does lift her game a lot from a lot of her previous roles, when she was never particularly a strong presence as an actor. in film. And Walken is a kind of charming geek in the movie. And it's nice to see young Christopher Walken. We got very much, most of our memories now are of older Walken. But at the time, you could see why he had the career he had. He really is great in this film. And he, the ensemble just works. The technology works. The story works. And even though it is kind of had its tail bobbed, I think it's a worthy science fiction film and it's worth revisiting. I wouldn't mind getting a Blu-ray of it. I'd really love to get a Blu-ray of it. I'm not sure what I'm going to afford to at the moment. And having said that, I am now going to go online and see what I can find out about whether it has been released on Blu-ray or not, so I can pass that information on. Just be a moment. And this is very fascinating for everybody listening, of course, while I type on my second screen to see whether Brainstorm is on Blu-ray. Let's have a look here. It is on Blu-ray, according to this, and I'm just waiting for it to kick through because I only have ADSL dial-up. It's not too bad. I'm going to buy it. I think it's worth getting on Blu-ray because of that different aspect ratio thing that's happening there. And I'm really fond of the movie for that reason, that I do think it hits a lot of the buttons that I like in a good hard science fiction movie, and yet it tells a human story, which is a big plus as well. So having said all that, I'm going to take another break and another espresso now, and when I get back, it's time for feedback.
I've lived in a home. I traveled in trailers when I used to roam. But now in these places you won't have me dead, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. I do what I want to, no worries, no cares. If anyone bugs me, I climb little stairs, way up to a level where astronauts tread, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. It's here, tiny nothing, I couldn't care less. I don't rush for buses and trains are a mess. There's no one to care for, I don't make a bed, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. I like how I'm living, I'm nobody's slave. My head's above water, so don't make a wave. There's no door to lock and no dog to be fed, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. So why should I move when the neighborhood's right? No taxes to pay and no landlord to fight. Now I call this a day once more and I said, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. Now you keep your ulcers, your ills and what's new. You sure couldn't have them and live like I do. You think I have problems, but you do instead, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. I live with two people, I like both of them. He likes both of me and I like both of him. They're my alter egos and to them I wed, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. There's no civil status in my neighborhood. It's that kind of thinking that keeps it so good. I don't take a lead, but I like to be led, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. So why did I move when the neighborhood I traveled in play and don't like to roam. Now I want this living more as I get, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. Now you want your answer, no worry, no cares. If anyone has it, I want my ideas. Way up I don't level where I do not get, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. I live with new people, I like most of them. I don't run for money and I like more of them. Then I offer him or I don't have my bed, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. I like how I'm living, I'm my neighbor's way. My head's in my water, so don't make a way. I don't want to leave, but I like to be led, cause I'm happy I live in a split level head. Now why did I move when I'm able to hide? My family
That was Napoleon the 14th with Split Level Head, and it's kind of apt too because we have a voicemail from somebody who arguably could have a split level head. It's our old friend Dr. Zom.
Hey, cool daddy-o. This is Dr. Zom, and I'm just calling the Martian Driving Podcast because I see that you are, reviewing a movie called The Invisible Boy from 1957. This doesn't have anything to do with that movie, but John Travolta was once in a movie called The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. It was made for TV, daddy-o. And I was listening to a book on, I guess they call it an audio book now. Almost said book on tape, but I'm a little old. And while listening to this audio book called Going Clear, they spoke about John Travolta working on The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. and that he had a girlfriend who played his mother in the movie. This whole book is about Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, David Miscavige, John Travolta, and a little guy named Tom Cruise. And I know that Martian Drive-In Podcast, it has to do with sci-fi, but and I know that in the I know that Terry Frost is an avowed atheist, but I was wondering if he's as intrigued by the entertaining, strange, and fascinating characters that believe in this occult and, well, how about with Scientology, maybe just a cult? But anyway, yeah, I'm tired of doing that voice. Then delving into the occult, the fascinating, and some shit like that. Aleister Crowley, Jack Whiteside Parsons, Wilhelm Reich, and some strange people, real people. And I was just wondering if Terry Frost has ever encountered any literature or movies about such real-life subjects. Maybe done in a fictional way, like mock-up on Moo. But anyway... if you have, and you have any recommendations, any films that might involve something like that, just let me know, because I think it's funny. I think it's entertaining, and even though these people are pretty much fucking, some of them lunatics, some of them are, I don't know, not leeches, but people that abuse and use the weak-minded, I find it fascinating. Anyway, I just wanted to call the new... voicemail, 206-338-9397, and, you know, I might just leave a voicemail, and this might be it.
Hey, Zom, nice to hear from you again, mate. Scientology, it's a cult, but then from my point of view, there's an argument for all religions being cults, so it just means that it's a little more recent than a lot of the others, but I hope it doesn't take root in society in the long term. And as far as Tom Cruise and John Travolta and McSavage are concerned, I think basically there are some incredibly criminal acts going on in that organization, allegedly, and it's really should be investigated a lot further. There are talks of incarcerating people who disagree with them, who are members of that particular cult, and other issues like that. And none of those kind of things I'm in favour of. I think that the incredible litigious nature of the organisation tends us to lead us to the conclusion that the reason it's so litigious is it has so much to hide, allegedly. So, yeah, they're fuckwits, basically. And as far as Aleister Crowley is concerned, I like Aleister Crowley as a concept. There are two things I'm going to direct you to that may help you with more info on Crowley. One of which is there's a documentary which is available on... about Aleister Crowley called Masters of Darkness, Aleister Crowley, the Wickedest Man in the World. I recommend that one. Now, the other, Aleister Crowley in movies, the best kind of iteration of Aleister Crowley in a movie that I know of, and it is a little bit oblique, comes from Jacques Tourneur's film Night of the Demon, also known as Curse of the Demon. The Julian Carswell character, played by Niall McGuinness, is kind of, sort of, Aleister Crowley, except he does know real magic. And I love the fact that... that's one of my favourite acting roles in all of cinema, is Niall McGuinness in that movie. It shows you the banality of real evil, where he plays a clown at a children's day that he has on his estate, and then raises a storm to prove to Dana Andrews that he actually can do magic. It's just a lovely bit of work there, but it is strongly based on Crowley. And it is my favourite kind of one of those sorts of things. But those characters are always interesting. Con artists of any kind are interesting, even when they piss me off. I think that the kind of mind that it takes to rip people off to that extent and to justify it beyond all rationality is something that cinema should do a lot more than it does. I mean, the problem with things like The Master, the Anderson movie with Philip Seymour Hoffman, is that it went soft on that kind of a belief system to a great extent. But yeah, they're interesting people, and it's an interesting phenomenon, and it's an interesting weakness that we have as a species, that this kind of person can in some way control the minds of large numbers of us. So thanks for that, Zom. Glad you're listening, and I'm glad that you got the new voicemail number. Please use it as often as you like, and we really should get you on a Martian drive-in at some stage. I know science fiction isn't really your big thing, but we still have fantasy and horror to look at, and we may be able to find something that suits you down to a T, and I really would like to. So on to more feedback. Mark Lipa sent me a copy of an article that he wrote about 8 years ago about The Invisible Boy, which I'm not going to read in full, but If you contact Mark R. Leeper, and you can usually find him by a quick Google search, see whether he can direct you in the right direction of getting a copy. But he does talk about The Invisible Boy in detail and compares it with the way that our computers actually went in real history as opposed to the future that is posited by that nice little movie. Very interesting. Thank you very much for that, Mark, and thank you very much for listening to the Martian Drive-In podcast. I also got a nice email from Ian Fryer up into North. He says, "Hi, Terry. Listening to you talk about The Invisible Boy, it struck me how often filmmakers over the years have reached for the supercomputer takes over the world plot. Just before listening to Martian Drive-In, my partner Jackie and I watched it done really badly in the 2008 film Eagle Eye, starring the charisma vacuum that is Shia LaBeouf. What the hell happened to him? He was great in Disturbia and terrible in everything else he's ever done. My favourite example is Colossus of Forbin Project from 1970, which seems to be screened by the BBC all the time when I was growing up. The strange antiseptic atmosphere of the film and the gradual realisation that Eric Braeden is a prisoner of the supercomputer Colossus sticks in my mind years later. I never did reply to your question about Martian Drive-In and Paleo Cinema being split on iTunes. Well, to me, I tune in to hear what you've got to say. I know we've never met, but with the personal nature of your podcast, I can't help but think of you as my mate Terry in Australia. I also like mixing up genres and worry slightly about science fiction being stuck in its own ghetto. I love that the likes of us can discuss Godard in one breath and Robinson Crusoe on Mars in the next. It's up to you if you want to put this next bit in the podcast. I'm not after free advertising. I will anyway. I've attached an article I finished writing tonight which I thought you might find interesting. Instead of doing a straight review of DVDs, I was writing about... I've tried to do something a bit more personal. The last two paragraphs are the nearest thing I've ever written to my credo on how to watch classic films. Probably a reaction to having one too many cinema screenings of an old film spoiled by a guffawing idiot in the row behind me. Hope all is good with you and Sal. I look forward to hearing the next podcast. Ian. Now, I'm just going to take a look at the doc and I'll might read out the credo if that's okay, and I'm sorry that if it's not. Let me just see what we've got down here. I'm scrolling through it now. Okay, I found it now. Here's Ian on his credo of movies, and I'll go from the bit that seemed relevant. Ignored or laughed at by their original audiences, and probably by many since, if you're in the right frame of mind, Devil from Mars and Crossroads to Crime have things to enjoy about them for the modern viewer, even if it's just a patina of period charm. There's an art to watching older films, which might uncharitably be called making allowances. They exist simultaneously in two eras at once, the time in which they were made and the time in which the viewer is watching them. We live in the latter space, but in order to get the most out of the film, it helps to at least attempt to place yourself for 90 minutes or so in the former. I'm not meant to like Crossroads of Crime. Jerry didn't like me to remind me of it, and the surviving cast members don't think much of it either. It's not a good film, and I'm not supposed to gain any level of enjoyment from it. But then as a full-grown adult, I'm apparently not supposed to like Thunderbirds and Stingray either. Yep, thanks for that, Ian. And yeah, I agree. Getting yourself into a period headspace and watching older films is useful, and it's easy to slip into once you get the practice of it. For me, I naturally slip into it. If I'm watching a 1940s movie, I know it's from the 1940s. I don't try to apply it a veneer of political correctness or gender politics into it at all. I think that that's a self-defeating thing. You don't enjoy the movie and you're pissed off by something else in the world. I do understand if it's a modern film, if it's a film made in 2013 and it gets the gender politics wrong and it treats women badly and it doesn't survive the Bechdel test where two women are only ever in any scenes because they're talking about a man, that kind of thing. I think that's one thing, but a film in an old, from an older period of time does have to be evaluated on its own playing field. You can't adjust things like that because you're not going to like any film if you do that. Humphrey Bogart, you're not going to like for anything except maybe Casablanca because he was against the Nazis. It's just it's a skill and it's a something you have to try the first time it happens. Or maybe it just happens naturally anyway, because as you got older, the movies you saw as a younger person fall into that historical context. And because of that, you naturally slip into evaluating them on their own terms rather than through a 21st century eye. And yeah, I totally agree with what you said there, and thank you for bringing it to me. It's so incredibly useful to occasionally state what to some of us is obvious but may not be to others. And I think that's very much a case in point of that. Movies are of their time, and I'm not really going to complain about Georges Méliès' moon movie, you know, Voyage to the Moon, because the chicks had fat legs, for instance. It's really not what the movie's about. Even at the time, it was just a little entertainment and a conceit, and you can't really criticise it for that. Now, that's about it this time around for the Martian Driving podcast. This one went incredibly smoothly, maybe because of the movies involved and maybe because of the audience. But one way or the other, that's it this time around. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and I promise not to do French New Wave movies for a while. So in the meantime, enjoy your movie watching, and I should tell you what my decompression movie is that I'm going to watch. I always watch a movie totally different from the ones I podcast about after I finish a podcast. Now just let me get my movie list up here and I'll just see what I've got on here. Probably, he said, filling for time, I am going to watch It's a Disaster, which is a recent comedy with David Cross in it about the end of the world. There's a lot of end of the world comedies, but this one's been recommended to me, so I'm going to watch that one. So, by the way, after I got off track a little bit there, Ian, so I'm going to go back to Ian's thing. Yep, well, if you're going to think about me as your mate Terry in Australia, I'm going to think about you as my mate Ian in Leeds. I think that's only reasonable, and thank you for the kind things you've said about the podcast. I do try to keep them personal and personable. I think I find the information goes through a lot smoother there. I've seen some, and this isn't anybody that I mentioned at the end of podcast, but I have heard some podcasts where there's a certain pane of glass between the audience and the people talking at them, and I try to remove that. I really don't want that there. I want it to be sometimes it's a monologue, sometimes it's a conversation, but one way or the other, it's just a bit of a chat about movies and what I like about them. So anyway, I'm going to go off now because it's espresso o'clock. And I'll catch up with you guys in 2 weeks. Take care and look after yourselves.